This is an ABC podcast.
The world's number one tennis player, Ipswich's own Ash Barty, who right now is competing in Wimbledon, credits a man she calls Crowy with making her a better player and a better person. Crowy, Ben Crowe, is a mindset coach. And alongside Ash Barty, he mentors a host of Olympians, champion surfers and AFL premier teams. But Ben says he's not really interested in winning or medals or titles. What he cares about in the athletes he works with is that they find fulfillment and meaning. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Very well. So Ash is playing in Wimbledon right now. Is this a stressful time for you?
Supposedly not. I'm supposed to be the one that teaches acceptance and the things we can't control and focusing back on the things we can. So it's a stressful time from a time zone point of view, Sarah, because, I'm up most of the night during these international events. So I've kind of got jet lag without the jet. So you don't even get the Qantas pajamas and the champagne, or it's kind of like being hungover without any alcohol. That makes sense. So it's stressful from a point of view of sleep deprivation, but no, it's normally a really exciting time just to see Ash and other athletes kind of go after their dreams and goals and see what they're capable of and getting out of their comfort zone. Obviously it's a bizarre time with the whole world really in terms of the changes and the nuances that comes with living in a bubble and so forth for Ash and everyone else. And yeah, I'm supposed to be in Wimbledon right now, so a little sad that we can't be, because it's such an amazing event and such a beautiful part of the world. So, but it is what it is. And really excited for I'm nervous about her body, I guess, because the uncontrollables of her injury is something we haven't kind of come across for a while. But she's got an amazing team around her with Mel, her physio, and Craig, her coach, and so forth. And she talks about her team a lot, but I do believe she's got an amazing team around her.
For you as her performance coach or her mindset coach, what's running through your head while you're watching her play?
Just really observing to see where there may be any distractions. Our flavour of distractions can come from anywhere. If we attach value to a particular point, good or bad, that can be a distraction, as much as the weather, the conditions of our life can be a distraction. So when I'm watching athletes perform, my role, I guess, is just to see if there's any distractions, either from body language or decision making and so forth. And then post-match to critique that event and just see where their mindset was out there, and then potentially discuss that and get things out of an athlete's head. If you're in your head, you're dead kind of thing. So the goal is to kind of just to be open and open-minded and kind of reflect so that you can work on and learn and grow for the next match.
So really, as you're sitting here in Australia watching her play a match, there's something she might do on the court that will make you think, I need to check in with her about her focus or her attention in that moment. You can pinpoint it like that.
Not always, and it's always a two-way dialogue as well, and a three-way dialogue with Craig Tizer, her brilliant and amazingly humble coach. So it's very much a dialogue amongst all of us, I guess, just to see what the priorities are, both from a skill set and a training point of view, but also from a mindset point of view as well. And sometimes it's just to not overthink it and just bring a lightheartedness, carefree, childlike kind of approach back to the game, and kind of, she's at her best when she's enjoying playing. If you think about it, games are based on the principles compete, have fun and play. So we can overthink it. And so getting back to those childlike principles and having a laugh and not taking life so seriously and kind of separating who she is from what she does and her self-worth and whether she wins or loses a game of tennis can actually be part of the whole process, where the rest of the world is taking it very seriously and obsessed by results and winning and losing and, judgments and opinions. Sometimes it's also important just to let go of all that noise. And sometimes it's actually helpful for me not to be at events, so I'm not kind of caught up in all those distractions and gossip and winning and losing and so forth, and you kind of get that clarity sometimes.
You can just give her a report on what's happening with the surf in Melbourne or something.
Yeah, totally. Bell's Beach was pumping this morning. Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
I think one of the things that really strikes viewers about her is how calm she stays in critical moments. How does she do that?
Well, she realizes she's in control of her emotions and her feelings and the words she sends from her conscious mind to her unconscious mind that determines how she shows up and so forth. And she goes back to words which represent who she is when she's at her best. So right now, Sarah, if you focus on being calm, it's physically, scientifically, medically impossible for you to be anxious at the same time. But the opposite is also true. If you let the conditions of your environment or the situation of your life determine your mindset, then, and it's a clutch point or so forth, that those conditions can often distract you. So she often just goes back to that childlike, carefree, without consequence mindset, and doesn't get distracted by the outcome, which she can't control, and expectations of others, which she also can't control. And focusing on something you can't control but wanting to control it is the definition of anxiety or stress or pressure or worry. So once you can let go of those things you can't control and focus back on the things you can, and I guess the two things she can control is her intention, if you like, her strategy and tactics that she works on with Ties, and her mindset. And once she realizes it's her decisions, not the conditions, that determines her mindset, her attitude and her self-worth, then she just finds the best version of her. And one of those words might just be calm, and that's what she focuses on.
I think she's spoken in press conferences about calling to mind images too from when she was a kid, or photographs. What's that process?
Yeah, it's one of the greatest exercises we can do to reframe the not enoughness or the shame stories that we're so good at telling ourselves, not good enough, smart enough, loved enough, successful enough. In the spirit that we are the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, a beautiful exercise is to reclaim our earliest, happiest memory, and it might be a photograph that we reflect on before judgments and opinions, and we thought we had to fit in. And so when anyone goes back and can reclaim their earliest, happiest memory, and then reclaim the words that best describes how you were feeling in that memory, you'll find words like calm or like free or carefree or happy or loved or belonged or safe or excited and adventurous, because you're climbing a tree, right, as a little girl or a little boy. And if you can hang on to those words, that can affect and focus more on the human being, not on the human doing that has to achieve and is based on results and cares what other people think about them. And Ash is very, very good at reclaiming those beautiful memories and images and visualizations that remind her not to take life so seriously and to celebrate that exciting, carefree, without consequence journey. But it's really hard as we become adults. We get distracted by thinking we have to do something or achieve something in order to be someone. And Ash is now very much in touch with who she is as a human being, less so the human doing. And it can be a superpower. Well, you know, her opponents are maybe berating themselves for making mistakes. She can have this kind of incredulous smile or laughter that, you know, I can't believe that imperfection happened, but, you know, you accept it, you let go, and you reframe and you go again.
I think that one of the things that goes along with that is this graciousness that she displays when competing, like in the match she had with Carla Suarez Navarro in this first match at Wimbledon, and she joined the crowd in applauding her opponent who'd been sick with cancer and is going to retire. Does that kind of behaviour, that kind of sportsmanship, come naturally to Ash Barty?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, is it natural or is it nurtured? I don't know from a neuroscience point of view that answer. What I do know is that she has the most amazing family around her. Her sisters and her parents and her partner, Gary, and so forth. And her early coaches as well. She's just surrounded herself with the most amazing people. And from that place has established her values from her greatest role models. And those values could be, you know, resilience or determination or courage, but it also could be love and empathy and care and kindness and compassion. And from she shows up from those values, that determines her behaviours, if you like. And well, don't get me wrong, she would love to win Wimbledon. It's great that she's world number one, but she also knows that that doesn't define who she is as a human being. And she can keep perspective on, you know, doing the right thing for the right reason in the right way, and not get you're distracted by either ego or fear or fame.
You know, I have to say, it's always struck me as someone who's obviously of a pettier mindset than Ash Barty or the other greats, is that competitors can go from that really, really fierce combat and turn on a dime and then shake hands and give each other a hug or smile. I mean, I think that's an incredible ability to switch modes that you see in a Grand Slam match, for example, or in a football field, or really most sporting arenas.
Absolutely, yeah. And that can be one of the biggest distractions too, when you bring your human being elements onto centre court. When you're playing sport, you're always the hunter. You're always the competitor, the warrior. And it's social Darwinism at its best, right? It's kill or be killed. But as soon as you get off the court, it's all about humility and compassion and perspective and care, if you like. And if you get that separation right, you've got a beautiful life, right? Because you focus on your mindset on the field in a professional sense, but also your perspective off the field in a personal sense, and find that balance between, I guess, confidence and happiness, if you like, or achievement with fulfillment. Most people don't realize that Roger Federer focuses his whole life on three words: humility, gratitude, and humor. Now, those three words have nothing to do with playing tennis, but they have everything to do with him becoming, you know, one of the greatest tennis players on the planet in terms of his perspective. And Ash Barty is very, very similar to Roger in that sense of getting that perspective right. So, you know, she loves to compete and loves to find a way through to defeat her competitors, and will do anything she has. She's the most competitive person I've ever seen. But off the court, she's also the most beautiful, humble, respectful, caring human being you'll ever see as well.
How did you begin working with her, Ben?
She had a bit of a setback in Wimbledon 2018, and I mean, her story is amazing. She starts playing tennis when she's 5 years old. You know, she wins junior Wimbledon at the age of 15, but then got distracted, I guess, with all the, you know, the pressure and the external noise, if you like, and then took a break from tennis, and kind of found herself, and then came back again, but then had another distraction on center court, she woke up the next morning from a defeat. She goes, that's not who I am. I don't know who I am, but that's not her. And I can't retire again. I'm only 21 years old. And she decided to go on a journey to work and make sense of who she was first and foremost. And I had been working with Richmond Football Club, that particularly with Trent Cotchin and Damien Hardwick and a few of the other leaders at Richmond, and Peggy O'Neill and so forth. And when Ash came to live in Melbourne, she was training with Trent Cotchin and the Richmond players and developed a friendship with them. So she was fully aware of the transformation of Richmond Football Club from 2016 to 2017, and I guess the work that I'd done with Trent, and she reached out to Trent, as did her manager Nikki, who's a very close and dear friend of mine, as did Craig Tizer, her coach. Ash then came down. We spent a few very emotional days together, and kind of been working together ever since.
What was the emotion?
Making sense of our life story. There's kind of two questions that any human in the world has to answer. Who am I? And what do I want? And we have to answer them in that order, because we can't work out what we want until we work out who we are fundamentally. But most of us don't want to do that because we're so scared what we might find is maybe I'm not good enough, or maybe I'm not loved enough or smart enough. So we keep that mask on and that armor on for self-preservation purposes, because I don't want you to know that I'm not enough something. And it can be, and that's what most of us don't want to do that. But to Ash's credit, she lent in to the risk and the uncertainty, the emotional exposure to make sense of her story and to reframe or let go or accept or forgive these moments when she might have told herself she's not good enough or loved enough or smart enough or whatever it is, not pretty enough. And then she could reframe that and realize that her life story is not her life, it's just her story. And now that she's the author of her own story, she's got the power to write the narrative, if you like, and which means she's got the power over her own perspective. And it's incredibly scary, I guess, at start. I mean, it's incredibly transformational as well, but it also can be really emotional when you give yourself permission to be imperfect and have a bit more self-compassion and self-acceptance and self-worth, and just to be able to say, you know what, yes, I am imperfect and I'm full of struggle and I don't have all the answers. And so forth, and life's really scary. But you know what? I am worthy of love and belonging and connection and going on a journey to extract whatever, you know, God-given gifts I've been given. To give yourself permission to go on that journey can be, you know, quite confronting.
There's a lot of trust involved too. I mean, it's the kind of trust that I guess people take to a therapist or to an intimate partner, to kind of meet someone in a professional context and have the trust to talk about your deepest fears or share your deepest anxieties. How do you get these elite athletes to trust you in that initial interaction? What are you doing?
I guess from a reputational point of view, I've been working with athletes for about 30 years, back in the Nike days. I started working with a lot of athletes, and a lot of them were tennis players, Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras and so forth. And I guess along the journey, where with permission from the athletes, I can share stories that they've already shared, but I can also share the principles behind them, so that athletes can realize through pattern recognition, go, oh my God, you know, she or he had the exact same issues that I've got right now. And more excitingly, there's a way through them. So when they can realize that it's not like they're a loser, everyone else has got their life in order, when they realize that there's common thought patterns, if you like, then wow, okay, I want to sign up for that, if you like. So it's very much storytelling based and analogy and metaphor based. You also got to remember that most athletes, you know, most clients come to me when they're on their knees, you know, and the reason your greatest growth comes from your darkest times, if you lean in, that is that it creates this humility and this curiosity, this openness to go, righto, nothing else is working, so maybe I'll try a different perspective. And if they respect or relate to the stories that I'm telling them, either about the athletes or about the outcomes of the athletes and teams, whether it's the Australian cricket team after Sandpaper Gate, or whether it's Richmond after 2016, or whether it's Ash Barty after a setback, you know, they'll all look back on those moments as a blessing, because they've realized that through that adversity came the curiosity and the humility to find a different way through and a different perspective and a way to live your life that balances confidence with happiness.
As you mentioned, there were times earlier in her career where Ash Barty walked away from tennis and actually played cricket, astonishingly, for a year or so. And I think she spoke at the time about really wanting a break from that individual focus that is so inherent in tennis to the experience of a team sport. How different is it for an athlete to have the solo focus that they have in tennis than being in a team? What does it demand differently from you in working with a individual athlete versus a team?
Yeah, it's a lot more lonely when you're playing in an individual sport versus a team sport where you can share and create an environment for others to be successful. And that human connection you get through team sport is quite amazing, if you like. And while you don't get that from an individual sport, the intelligent ones like Andre Agassi or Ash Barty that create a team environment behind them that enables them to move from I to we, and Ash is probably, you know, the greatest example of someone who always talks about the we, less so the I, and that's because she's not playing for herself. She's playing for, you know, her coach and her family and, you know, for Australians and for Indigenous Australians and so forth. So she can develop that purpose mindset and find a why beyond just the individualism. Whereas in a team sport, by virtue of playing with others and helping others and serving others and making their day, and you know, the great teams are the ones that create an environment for each other to be successful. And it's amazing what can be achieved when no one cares who gets the credit. Sometimes it's easier to create that environment in a team sport versus versus an individual sport.
You say that you started working with Ash after she'd had a setback after Wimbledon in 2018, and really reinventing her purpose and focus. And, you know, it worked, because in 2019 she won the French Open, her first Grand Slam title. Where were you watching that, Ben, that final?
Yeah, I didn't go to the French. It was quite interesting. Ash said before the French Open, she goes, don't come over, Crowy, I suck on clay. So if that's her example of someone who sucks on clay, I'd like to see someone who's good on clay. So I was actually down the Great Ocean Road at our beach house at Fairhaven. And that was the most extraordinary week, probably 2 or 3 days of my life. And I was asked, not towards the end of 2019, what was my greatest memory of that year across all my clients? And I said it was the semi-final of the French Open. And I don't know if you remember the game that night, Sarah, but Ash is, I think, 5-1 up, 40-15 up. So it's effectively an unlosable set. And she got distracted. There was rain delays, a bit of momentum coming the other way and so forth, a range of different things. And anyway, she lost the point, lost the game, lost the next game, lost the next game, and lost the next. And she lost that unlosable set. And it got worse. She's 3-love down in the second set. And I've got imposter syndrome like you wouldn't believe. I was like, oh, my God. Yeah. Supposed to be the mindset guy, Crow, you loser. And at 3-love down in the second set, Ash sits down and... And you can see the body language in her in this moment. It's almost like she starts laughing and she goes, yeah, well done, Ash. Clearly you're going to lose this match today after being 5-1 up in the first set. But you're letting the conditions of your environment determine your mindset. And she just kind of shakes her head, laughs, and goes, no way. She goes, I decide my mindset. I decide my attitude. I decide my self-worth. I decide. And she reclaimed the words that represent the best version of her and why she plays the game. And with that attitude change, she gets up out of her chair and she breaks the girl's serve for the first time in 9 games. She then holds her own serve for the first time in 9 games. And then she wins the next 6 games in a row. She wins the set 6-3. She wins the next set 6-2. And the next day, she wins the French Open. Right? And then 2 weeks later, she goes to Birmingham, England, I think it was. And then she becomes the number one tennis player on the planet. And her life will never, ever, ever be the same again, right? But if you go back to that moment at 3-love down in the second set, she had a choice to make. She could let the conditions of her environment determine her mindset. Or she goes, screw that. I decide my mindset. I decide my attitude. I decide my self-worth. And most of us don't realize that. We let the conditions of our environment, our version of a pandemic, kind of determine our mindset. And one of my greatest heroes is Viktor Frankl, who's arguably the world's greatest psychiatrist, who survived the Auschwitz concentration camp while his wife perished, his parents perished, his brother perished, his mates perished. He got out of there and he wrote this book called Man's Search for Meaning, and he wrote it in 7 days. And the most famous line in that book is, everything can be taken from a person except for one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And Ash Barty actually understands that principle fundamentally. Don't get me wrong, she's human, right? So she's imperfect and she'll get distracted and fall down like the rest of us will. But more importantly, when she has these crucible moments in her life, she can understand that she has the power to either accept this as something she can't do, but if there is something she can do, to take control, but more importantly, realize it's her decisions, not the conditions, that determines that attitude.
And you sitting in your beach house go from feeling like the world's greatest imposter to the world's greatest mindset coach, I hope, Ben. I hope there was a moment of celebration for you as well.
Well, yes and no. I think I spoke to her after the game and she's a very emotional person, Ash, which is her greatest strength, in my opinion, and just her passion and her love and so forth. But there was just nothing but tears after the game and all the next day. And I spoke to her coach and Nikki, her manager, and I just said, look, whatever you do, just make her laugh. I don't care if you've got to run nude through the streets of Paris, but just
what is the best way to make Ash Barty laugh, out of interest?
She has the most amazing sense of humour, wicked sense of humour, Ash does. So laughing at the incredulous nature of life or of individuals finding the humour through that perspective is the best way to make Ash Barty laugh by far.
And what about other interests? I mean, what about the balance in her life? How much emphasis do you give to things outside of tennis, and what do they offer someone like that?
Yeah, so I guess the three questions we work on with clients, the first one is, who am I? Which is that, it's what we call connection mindset, which is connecting with ourselves first and foremost before we connect with the outside world, and we're able to kind of embrace our weird, as we say, and celebrate our imperfections, but find that unconditional self-worth. Once you've answered that question, then you can go after the second question, which is, what do I want from this crazy thing called life? And that's often where we can find happiness, especially if unlocking what we want not only unlocks a sense of purpose and meaning and contribution beyond ourselves, but it also unlocks our values and our goals and our dreams and our motivations and our needs, if you like. So for Ash, in terms of what she wants outside of tennis, so she will set goals for herself. Absolutely. But those goals are professional goals, but they're also personal goals. So she might have extrinsic motivations, which might be to world number one or win certain grand slams and so forth, or, you know, reach a certain status in an external sense. But then she'll develop her intrinsic goals, which is very much around what lights her up internally inside of herself, which might be, you know, getting out of her comfort zone or helping others or realizing her potential or finding a sense of purpose and meaning in her life.
How important are her dogs in meeting the goals rather than the expectations?
Oh my God, yes. Ash, her love of dogs, and I totally get it, right? I absolutely love dogs as well. I've had dogs all my life as well. But there's something a bit like dolphins and whales, I think. There's something spiritual about the unconditional love and loyalty and gratitude that comes from dogs. And she absolutely has that connection with dogs. And she's an ambassador for the RSPCA as well in Queensland. And, yeah, just the I don't know what it is. I know she's got five dogs.
Five.
And she's also loves she also loves coffee. And so the dogs are named after, you know, Chino and Fagato and so forth. I think it's because of the unconditional love that dogs provide. But dogs have the most amazing perspective, right? You know, if a dog loses its leg and becomes a three-legged dog, the first thing it does after surgery and after recuperation is it gets back in the park and it starts to run around and wag its tail and it starts to adapt, right? And it just celebrates the fact that it's still living and its opportunity and so forth. And we can learn so much from dogs. Ash understands that. I guess connection is why we're here as humans, right? We're neurobiologically hardwired for connection. Now, primarily that's humans, but it's also connection to nature and it's also connection to animals. And Ash has that absolutely love of connection to nature. She loves walking barefoot in grass. That's why she loves Wimbledon so much, in my opinion. It's obviously why she loves people and people love her, but she also has that same connection with animals as well.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Ben, is this the kind of work that you imagined yourself doing as you were growing up?
I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up, Sarah. It's a beautiful experiment for me as well. Absolutely not. No, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. I initially wanted to be a lawyer. My sister's a lawyer and she's a couple of years ahead of me and I missed out by 5 marks. And my family are very much in the service orientated. They're teachers and lawyers and doctors and nurses. And I think I may have wanted to be a wannabe of all of those disciplines. And I ended up doing an arts degree and I focused on anthropology, philosophy and English. And I had no idea, and you know, as Steve Jobs says, you can only join the dots looking back on your life, but I had no idea at the time that anthropology was the study of humans and human behavior. Philosophy was the study of wisdom. And English, effectively, as far as my interpretation goes, specializes in storytelling. And 30 years later, that's actually all I do with clients, is helping understand the sense of humanity and human behavior, if you like, and focus on these principles of wisdom that, you know, and in particular the Stoics and Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius and so forth have the most amazing perspective that can teach us so much today. And storytelling, if you like, but most of my life has been spent, I guess, on external storytelling. And I guess the last 2 or 3 decades has probably been working on the internal storytelling and the stories that we tell ourselves and realize it's not the experiences of our life that determine our life. It's the meaning we put behind those experiences, right? The narrative, the stories we tell ourselves about the experiences. Two people can have the exact same experience for two very different interpretations or meanings or stories that we tell ourselves. So, it's been fascinating how the storytelling's flipped from all the external storytelling more so to the internal storytelling. I guess I learned that at Nike, which is a very much a storytelling platform, and that's its competitive advantage against the Germans, as they call them, Adidas and Puma.
I'm going to ask an ignorant question. I thought they sold sand shoes and track suits. What do you mean they're a storytelling platform?
Well, good question, Sarah. That's what they do. But that's not why they do it, right? So selling shoes is what they do, but that doesn't define the depth of them. Their purpose, if you like, as an organization, is to bring innovation and inspiration to every athlete in the world. And if you've got a body, you're an athlete, yeah? And they innovate through product development and they inspire through storytelling. And whether it was Live Strong or Air Jordan or Just Do It, it was always the emotional connection of the athlete and the story, which is its competitive advantage. Whether you're a company or whether you're an individual, once you can work out your why, your purpose, then you can work out your story, which is kind of like, you know, what's your external representation of that? And then what's the best way to tell that story? Yeah, so it's a long way of answering your question. No, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. I guess I had a curiosity, and my first job out of uni was working with Hockey Australia, with the Australian Hockey Association, and they gave us a lot of freedom to be creative and have a bit of fun, because hockey, field hockey, is a very strong participation sport, but kind of quite a low profile consumer based sport. So they wanted to get more storytelling based. So we changed the name of the men's team to the Kookaburras to bring that kind of metaphorical visualization.
And why the Kookaburras? Why are the Kookaburras chosen as the name for the men's hockey team?
Well, I heard the CEO of Hockey Australia about 10 years ago, and I left there 30 years ago, right? So I heard in an interview, was explaining the king of the bush and the strongest bird and all these idiosyncratic caricatures of the kookaburra was the reason that we named this bird. And I was thinking to myself, wow. From my memory, Kookaburra, which is an Australian company, offered us an enormous amount of money to name the team the Kookaburras, and we all found a legitimate, authentic reason why it made absolute sense to call it the Kookaburras. It was kind of like a win-win.
That might be the secret of sports marketing right there, the commercial imperative and the mythological vision at the same time.
Oh, totally. Exactly right. Yeah. Retrospectively, you can create any story to suit the purpose, yeah?
Ben, you said that you ask Ash and other athletes to call to mind their happiest early memory. What's yours?
What? You want me to be vulnerable, Sarah? I only teach this stuff. I'm not good at it. My earliest, happiest memory, it would be, I reckon I was in grade four, St. John's Mitcham in Victoria, and my mum, I'm the youngest of six, and my mum came up to the school. It was a really hot day on a Friday, came up about lunchtime and got me out of school, which was the first win. And then we drove to Torquay and spent the whole afternoon and evening. I think daylight savings had come in on the beach at Torquay, and she'd gone to rent a house for the summer, I think, and wanted to get in early with the house rentals then. And I just remember being on the beach with two of my three sisters and my two brothers and mum, and I think from there that's just created this incredible connection with the ocean, which I still have. This incredible connection with family, which I still have as well, and I guess a connection with adventure. And the words which best describes that that memory for me is one of my earliest, happiest memory. Well, happy obviously would be one of the words. Loved would be another word. Definitely excited, because I'm getting out of school and I'm going, you know, on my surf mat in the 1970s, and I guess a feeling of safe and belonged, and I guess free or carefree would be another word that I'd probably represent that memory. And that's the amazing thing about that, is that I can show up today and be that person. I don't need money. I don't need anyone else. I don't need any external influence or validation to be that person. I can wake up this morning and say, I am happy, I am loved, I am carefree, I am safe, I belong. But we forget as we get older, we get adults, we get pimples, we think we have to fit into a tribe. And as soon as we do that, we kind of lose our authenticity. We lose the most authentic version of ourselves, because we don't want to fit into what someone else has prescribed, what we think their expectations are of us, or what we think they think of us. And that's why reclaiming these words, and I guess focus more on the human being and less so the human doing. And I'm kind of hoping at the outset of COVID that we start to remember that. I asked all my clients at the start of COVID, say to all of them, right, regardless of whether you're religious or you believe in God, let's just assume for the purpose of the exercise, the world's trying to tell us something. And I'd say, what do you reckon she's trying to tell us? And unanimously, every client all over the world said the same thing. They said, they reckon the world's trying to tell us to stop doing and start being, to do less and be more, yeah, be more connected to myself or family or friends, and to stop saying busy when someone says, how are you? You know, yeah, since when did busy become an emotion, or for crying out loud? Busy's an addiction, not an emotion. So your earliest, happiest memory and other exercises you can do to reclaim the human being, you know, what kind of human you want to be this year, can start from your earliest, happiest memory and reclaim that and show up from that perspective today.
You say you're the youngest of six. I'm the youngest of seven, Ben. So just a stab in the dark here, but were your parents Catholic too?
Yes, they were very, very, very strong Catholics, my mum very religious, and definitely I'm still very spiritual, I guess, more so than religious.
What was the atmosphere like in your house growing up with all those kids? Was it noisy? Was it chaotic? What do you remember about life at home?
Yeah, definitely chaotic. My dad, who passed away when I was 16, had an incredible need for laughter and playfulness. He was a very larrikin-like, mischievous, and so forth. And yeah, I have beautiful memories of mum being very strict Catholic. We're all kneeling down, saying decades of the rosary, and trying to be serious, and, you know, trying not to giggle or laugh as typical kids would. But then the phone would ring, and then all six kids would desperately bolt up and break the Olympic world record to get to the phone while Dad's laughing his ass off, and Mum's telling Dad off for encouraging that kind of bad behaviour. And then whoever answered the phone was the luckiest person on the planet.
Could have been like Mary on the line, directly answering one of those decades.
Totally. Yeah, exactly right. But sacrilegious. Someone said, Mum, God's on the phone, wants to have a chat to you about the amount of times we had to ring the rosary. Like, you know, come on, you know, get a grip.
Enough already. You've done it.
Like 5 decades? Like, you're serious? Like, way past our bedtime. But yeah, so I have beautiful memories of, yes, it was very, I guess, strict at times and I guess rules and regulations and so forth, but incredible amount of love and laughter and celebration. And back in those days in the 1970s, the Sunday lunch was just such a beautiful, fun part of the week. You know, we'd come home from 11:15 mass, and sometimes Mum would invite a priest over, whatever, and, you know, you then play footy in the backyard in the afternoons and so forth. I have beautiful memories of that particular chapter.
Losing your dad as a teenager is tough. What were things like at home after that? How did the dynamic between you and your brothers and sisters change?
Yeah, it was definitely the hardest time of my life by far. I think I was 16 years old at the time. We were already a very close family. After Dad's passing, we became phenomenally close out of necessity to get help us all get through that, if you like. And yeah, the connection that we had, and both the support of Mum and Mum's support of us. My dad ran a cleaning company and cleaned schools and hired a lot of the local men and teenagers around the area. And when he passed away, my mum, who had never worked a day of her life in this company, she's 56 years old, I think, at the time, took over the family company without any experience whatsoever. And we all became directors at the age of 16 and 17 of this company. And, you know, I used to remember coming home from school to pay salaries and wages and work out tax and all those kind of things in pay slips and so forth. So I guess you had to kind of grow up really, really fast. And losing Dad. And it's funny, someone asked me recently about why I love Bruce Springsteen so much. I went to the Bruce Springsteen concert in 1985 with my brother and his girlfriend. And we listened to, you know, Bruce Springsteen all the way home, rah, 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 and then we got home, and then Dad had a heart attack about 2 hours later, and I was a wannabe surf lifesaver at Jan Juc, and so I did know CPR. I didn't realise my first patient would be my dad, and I have vivid memories of giving him mouth to mouth, and my brother, who'd done a little bit less than me of life saving. He was doing the CPR while I was doing the mouth-to-mouth, and I remember him looking at me one stage in that before the ambulance arrived, and I'll never forget that look. It was kind of like that look of, you know, what the hell are we doing in this moment? But it was also incredible, right? We're going to do everything we can to save our dad, right? And life doesn't prepare you for those kind of experiences. And I'll never forget that look of intention and love and care. A little bit of fear from both of us, obviously. And I remember, yeah, ever since then, whenever I hear a Bruce Springsteen song, I didn't realise at the time, he probably is one of the greatest storyteller musicians the world's ever seen from himself. And my love of music, I guess, has come from that as well. I remember going to bed that night. I remember after the ambulance arrived, my brother, who's a doctor, and he lives about 20 minutes away. I think he got there in 7 minutes, so he would have lost a fair amount of demerit points getting to the house. But I'd never seen him cry before, and I remember being in the lounge room waiting to see what's going on. Then I see him, my mum holding him up, Patrick, and he was crying his eyes out, getting teary. That, I guess, was the realisation that, yeah, I just lost my greatest role model in Dad. And I think I went to bed about an hour or two later and eventually fell asleep, woke up the next morning to the classic old AM/FM radios, and Joni Mitchell was singing Big Yellow Taxi. And I woke up, and you know that when you wake up, you've got no idea what happened the night before, or you're in that kind of dozing state. And I was actually in quite a happy state, and because I love Joni Mitchell. And it wasn't to the very last line of that song was, you know, doesn't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone, you know, and a big yellow taxi took my old man away. And I suddenly, oh my God, Dad died last night. And I remember just lying in bed and crying for like an hour or two, like nonstop, just thinking, God, how am I going to get through this? And I think that moment kind of unlocked this curiosity in me to kind of sense of purpose and perspective and finding meaning in life, which I found very quickly through just the love of family and friends and so forth. And that's probably taken me on that journey ever since then, and probably more luck than design that, you know, I started working in the sports industry and started working with athletes. But losing my dad back in that journey was probably the crucible moment that unlocked my journey in a certain way.
And inevitably, as a kid, when you lose someone close to you, particularly someone whose life you've been trying to save with your brothers, there's going to be guilt, there's going to be a sense of responsibility, however irrational that goes into you. Were you conscious of that at the time too?
No, not at all. Not at all. I remember having a conversation with my older sister, Marianne, and I was feeling guilty that I couldn't do anything because I was the youngest of the six, and they're all doing amazing things with the company, you know, picking up the pieces. Or Mum was, you know, extraordinary, obviously dealing with her own grief of losing her soulmate, and then having to pick up his company from scratch and run it for another 10 years to get us all through school and through college and so forth. And I felt like I wasn't doing anything, really. And I remember my sister, Marianne, just saying, just the way you can make people laugh and just be interested, I guess not interesting, was enough. And so I guess I thought, okay, that's good. I've got a role to play in this. It's a pretty small role in my opinion, but at least it was a role. And then from there, I think I talking to my mum and how she was dealing with it and how she was getting through it, she said to me, she looks at Dad as like an angel, and she can still talk to him. You know, she can't see him, but he can still hear her. And that was a really powerful metaphor for me to kind of get me through it, so I could still talk to him and have a laugh. And, you know, in certain situations when I had to make a critical decision, I'd say, right, what would Dad do here? And I didn't realize it at the time, but I was kind of dedicating a part of my life to Dad and to his name and in honor. And now when I work with coaches or CEOs or teams, I talk about the power of dedication. And Patrick Kisnorbo, who's the coach of the Melbourne City this year, he's the first coach to ever win the plate and the championship in his first year. He's also the only coach to ever win the A-League and the Women's League. And I started working with Patrick this year. What he did to the players pre-match on Friday, I won't go into it, but the power of dedication, because what happens is when you dedicate your performance or your life to someone else, to someone that's helped you get there along the way, it takes that performance to a much higher, a much deeper level. And it also loses a sense of ego and fear and just grounds us in this beautiful perspective when we can dedicate our lives or our performances to someone else. And I guess my life, yeah, looking back, it's definitely dedicating it to Dad and to, you know, a few other friends who I've lost along the way, that I can still say, right, what would Strikey do in this situation, or what would Hilly do, or what would my dad do in this situation? And that way I can honour them along my journey and feel a sense of appreciation and gratitude that I guess I'm still going. And I guess I owe it to them to do it in the best possible way.
It's such an interesting transformation, it seems, of the way we talk about sport and the way we talk about men in sport in particular, Ben. And I think about the work you've done with the Richmond Football Club, bringing in conversations around vulnerability and loss and failure. That's asking our male sports people in particular to present themselves and maybe see themselves in a completely different way.
Yeah, that you're spot on. And that's in 2019, that's when I started working with Ash a lot more detail in the Australian cricket team and working with Richmond. But I also travelled the world that year and started working with, you know, special operations groups in military and a lot of CEOs, and started working with teenagers as well. And I spent a week in Russia working with the top 500 CEOs over there. And I came back in December of that year and I wrote down in my journal, there's two types of people on the planet right now. Those who see vulnerability as a strength and those who view it as a weakness. And to your point, Sarah, unfortunately, for many decades coming out of war-torn countries in particular, we see vulnerability as a weakness. But if you see vulnerability as a weakness rather than a strength, you're quite closed-minded, defensive, on the back foot, you know, feeling like you're being attacked all the time. You're not compassionate, certainly for yourself, because you think you have to be this, you know, this perfect specimen, so you put that mask and that armour on for self-preservation purposes, because I don't want you to know that I'm not perfect. But then you won't create that human connection that as humans we're hardwired for. So everything we do now, unfortunately, is counterintuitive to how we're thinking, certainly males and certainly stoic Aussie alpha males that you referenced. Because if you go the other way, and any good snowboarder or skier or surfer would know counterintuitively, if you lean in, you stay up. And if you lean back, you fall back. So it's counterintuitive. You have to lean in to the risk and the uncertainty and the emotional exposure to put yourself out there and take off that mask and armor. And if you do, wow, it's extraordinary what happens to your life. You're more open, you're more open-minded, you're more curious, creative, adaptive, innovative. You're incredibly compassionate. And for me, this is the number one issue on the planet right now. We are so hard on ourselves as a human race. We've got this inbuilt negative reptilian brain with a negative bias. It's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. So we have to have more self-compassion and self-care and self-love, because then we can create that connection that as humans we're hardwired for. But we've been taught to not show our emotions, to keep that mask on, to try and be this perfect specimen, to suck it up when things don't go wrong. And in my opinion, that's why we're the most addicted, medicated, in debt, obese adult generation in the history of the world, because we're trying to numb emotions, but you can't selectively numb the negative without selectively numbing the positive as well. And Brené Brown, and the most amazing work she's done around the world in shame research, to try and understand why this is happening and how we can rectify it in terms of our perspective. Some of that research and the principles around to overcome those shame stories and reframe them is quite inspiring.
Have you seen then, say, with, say, the footballers you work with, have you seen individuals go from being pretty closed and pretty defensive to taking that risk to have the kind of conversations you're suggesting? Well, like, what does that look like?
Oh, absolutely. It's extraordinary when someone can reframe their life story. And Trent Cotchin is probably the greatest exampleist in AFL world, where he went on this journey to embrace vulnerability as probably the one thing he did, and that the whole club did in that shift in 16 to 17, was embrace vulnerability as a strength rather than a weakness. And when he got up in front of the whole playing group, you know, classic alpha male kind of culture, the coaches and so forth, and he got up there on stage and he stood up there in his own words, in his own way, he said, "I'm so sorry. For the last 5 years, I thought I had to be the perfect captain with the perfect pre-match speech and the perfect hairdo and the perfect this and the perfect that. And I'm here today to tell you that I'm not. I'm imperfect and I'm full of struggle and I'm shitting myself and I don't have all the answers and I can't do this on my own." Right? But I've also learned something else about myself. I've also learned that I'm worthy. I'm worthy of your love, belonging, connection, and taking you on a journey. And 9 months later, they won the unwinnable premiership. And Trent went from, you know, unofficially voted by negative media as the worst captain in the AFL to officially voted by his peers as the best captain in the AFL. Right? 3 premierships later in 4 years, you're kind of hoping that the rest of the AFL cohort realise that vulnerability is a superpower. Because as soon as he did that, he created permission and safety for everyone else in that organisation to embrace vulnerability as well. Suddenly they could take off their mask, right, and celebrate their imperfections and their insecurities and their weaknesses and talk about it and be more open and open-minded and compassionate to each other. That creates this connection that's been so celebrated down at Richmond from that place. And you find the joy. And if we don't create that, and it has to come from leaders, right? Leaders set the agenda in the same way that parents set the agenda in the house, and kids become a product of that environment. It's exactly the same in the workforce or in sporting teams. So if leaders embrace vulnerability as Trent and Damien did, or JL does, or other leaders do, it's amazing what happens to the whole environment. But as I said, unfortunately, it's counterintuitive. What do you mean celebrate imperfections? What do you mean embrace vulnerability? What do you mean laughter, have fun, you know, enjoy your time? No, it's got to be about, we've got to be serious, and it's got to be winning, and it's got to be results and so forth. And I think that's one of the greatest distractions today, is where we've lost the art of living, if you like, and the principles of vulnerability is such an important part of that.
As a dad yourself, Ben, have you been involved in coaching any of your sons as they've played sport? What's it mean on the home turf for you, this expertise and skill you have? How's it respected?
The expertise certainly doesn't translate my kids obviously get exposed to a lot of this, and they're very lucky because they love sport, right? They love surfing and football and tennis and so forth. So they get to experience a lot of the close-upnesses enough. But if I even bring up the word vulnerability at the dinner table, oh my God, I just get shot at dad. Dad, I'm not one of your test cases. Don't you dare go down that path. But I think the nuance, I guess the transference, the greatest 6 words that a coach can say to their athlete is also the greatest 6 words that a parent can say to their kids. I love to watch you play. Those 6 words are so powerful for unlocking this extraordinary compassion and unconditional love and sense of humanity. It's not based on whether you won or lost or how many goals you scored or whether you're in the A team or the B team or the D team, right? I love to watch you play, or I love to watch you dance, or I love to watch you draw. And bringing back some of those principles into coaching is so important. So I'd like to think I brought a few of those, but if you ask my 3 kids, Sarah, you could probably get 3 very different interpretations, if you like, of what I'm good at or what I'm definitely not good at.
Ben, it's been really fascinating to speak with you, and we'll keep our fingers crossed for Ash Barty over Wimbledon, but thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
My pleasure, Sarah. All the very best. And continue with your anthropology and philosophy and storytelling as well.
And next thing you know, I'll be coaching Ash. You just watch out. I'm making a move.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.